The Western Romance with Indigenous Cultures.
I want people to question all their assumptions about how they view Indigenous people and you know, what their own sort of preconceptions and tropes are. You know, the book is supposed to be a kind of a ripping yarn, this adventure tale that also works on a much deeper level and makes people question all their assumptions.
That's Carl Hoffman. We talk with him about his book, The Last Wild Men of Borneo, a true story of death and treasure. Then we talk with Jane Goodall's biographer, Dale Peterson, about his new book, The Ghosts of Gombe, a true story of love and death in an African wilderness. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Riana. Two modern adventurers sought a treasure possessed by the legendary wild men of Borneo. One found riches. Did he help or did he exploit the tribe's people he traded with? The other vanished forever into an endless jungle. Had he shed civilization or been murdered? Lured by these mysteries, New York Times best-selling author Carl Hoffman journeyed to find the truth. Hoffman follows the stories of Swiss adventurer Bruno Manser and American Michael Palmieri. Manser attained world renown fighting against the logging of the primeval forests of Borneo, the home of the Penan tribes. Palmieri became one of the world's most successful tribal art field collectors, supplying sacred works to prestigious museums and wealthy private collectors. These two men illustrate two sides of the same coin, Hoffman says, how Western tropes about tribal peoples shape the way the developed world deals with them. Carl Hoffman is the author of the New York Times bestseller Savage Harvest, the story of the mysterious disappearance of Michael Rockefeller in New Guinea in 1961. He's a former contributing editor to National Geographic Traveler and Wired, and has traveled on assignment to 80 countries. Carl Hoffman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much.
Your book, The Last Wild Man of Borneo, in many ways the theme explores the Western fascination with wild lands and so-called exotic peoples. You have your own fascination with Borneo, which is where the book is centered. Why is that?
Well, I grew up, you know, loving sort of being obsessed with adventure stories, and then that sort of led into stories of wild places and indigenous people. But like most people, I think that was, you know, you only know what you know, and you only know what you read. And, you know, I read all these. Borneo is sort of the classic place. I mean, the Dayak people, the indigenous people of Borneo were covered in tattoos and heavily ornamented and were dancers and artists and shamans and headhunters. And they were sort of the quintessence of exoticism for a Western boy. You know, and I read books like The Headhunters of Borneo, Karl Bach's 1800s book, and all of these books that sort of fetishize and exoticize the people. And I wasn't really until I went to Borneo for the first time in 1987 that I started to be confronted with those images and ideas and really to be challenged by them. And then in 2012, I did this book about the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller in New Guinea in 1961. And to understand what happened to Michael, I required living in a very remote village in a place called Asmat in New Guinea and in western Papua. And living in Asmat, I saw that, you know, Westerners kind of tend to project their own fantasies and desires and fears and needs on indigenous people. I mean, we kind of look at them as blank slates and utilize them for our own purposes in a way. And when I was living in Asmat, I began to question, to have all these questions. And at the same time, I had this desire to kind of stay forever, I mean, which is and become an Asmat and be adopted by the Asmat people, which is a long Western fantasy, you know. I mean, it's sort of the ultimate Tarzan fantasy, and part of me wanted to flee and run away. I mean, the reality is the Asmat live very hard lives. So it was all these big questions were kind of banging around in my head. And I started thinking about the story of Bruno Mansur, and Bruno had, was this Swiss guy who had gone to live with the Pinon, the hunter-gathering nomads of Borneo, and had become quite well-known. And he had sort of done what I fantasized about in a lot of ways, which was to kind of leave the world behind, his world behind. And he went in and didn't come out for 6 years.
Yeah, so the book centers on the story of these two Westerners, and I had to think to myself when I, after reading the book, I looked again at the title, The Last Wild Men of Borneo, A True Story of Death and Treasure. Is there a double entendre in that title?
A little bit, yes, and as is the cover photo, which shows at first glance of what appears to be an indigenous person, but is in fact not. It's Bruno Mansur. And, you know, the last wild men refers to, of course, the indigenous people of Borneo, but it also calls into question, you know, or points to highlights the acculturation, really, of that's going on in Borneo, and refers also to, in slightly tongue-in-cheek, perhaps, to Bruno and Michael, who, you know, are also trying to be, the last wild men of Borneo, even though they are not, even though they are Westerners and can never be anything but.
Hmm. The men are both very much alike in some ways and very different. Michael Palmieri made his career selling Indonesian traditional art to museums in the developed world, while Bruno Mansur tried to save the traditional way of life of the Pinang in their forest. But you say that the two narratives are really one. They are the story of the fate of Borneo. What do you mean by that?
Well, on the surface, Bruno and Michael are completely different kinds of men. I mean, Bruno was a pure idealist who wanted to initially just escape Western world, escape consumerism, and live in the belly of the mother, as he put it, with the Pinon. And, you know, and Michael was a buccaneer, I mean, who was interested in adventure, but also was trying to make a living, make a profit, buying and selling Dayak art. And so in that sense, they appear to be very, very different. But I think that not only did they come out of a very similar place, I mean, they were both baby boomers from rich Western countries who fled their militaries at a very particular time and sought a kind of solace, a treasure in the East and among indigenous people. But you know, they were both after this really the same thing. I mean, the art was just the physical expression of the world that that Bruno was trying to live. And so they were both after the same thing in very different ways. And in that way, I think they were sort of like two sides of the same coin. And that's the West's long fascination, which takes lots of different forms with indigenous people, in the sense that, you know, today it's kind of, we think of them as sort of new age spiritual gurus in a lot of ways. And, you know, who, if we can find them, if we can live with them, can offer solace and solutions to a lot of the ills that we find in Western culture today.
And what's your sense about that?
Well, I think that there's truths to that, but it's also complex, and that's the problem with those sorts of tropes. I mean, there's a lot of nuance and a lot of gray area. You know, people tend to hold the Pinon up as these perfect nature people. And, you know, Bruno was always, they were hunters. I mean, carnivores, they lived for hunting. And for instance, and Bruno was always trying to get them to stop killing when they had enough to eat, and they didn't want to, because that was how they lived. And, you know, he was amazed the time he saw them, they would not just hunt, but go after certain fruits. And, there was a particular tree, and when it was in fruit, they would just cut the tree down and take the instead of climbing to pick it up. And he was always telling, saying, why do you cut the tree down? Why don't you just preserve it? So, these icons of the natural world were human beings and not as simple as we imagine on the one hand. And Bruno was also somebody who, for all his idealism, let a lot of people down and was also could be very selfish. And Michael, on the other side, was buying art often for a very small price and selling it at a very high price and making a living from it. And as cultures were vanishing, and yet a lot of the art that he got wouldn't exist anymore if he hadn't have bought it. And it's available for people to look at and to think about in museums around the world. So I think the world is often not as black and white and simple as we imagine it.
You say that the Pinon recognized Bruno as a kindred soul, and it really is remarkable how he in some ways became one of them, although he also never became one of them. Just as you say, things are not always so easy, but they ultimately called him Pinon Man. So talk about this remarkable feat of how he integrated himself with the tribe.
Well, Bruno was a remarkable person. I mean, there's just no sort of other way to look at him. Since he was a child, he was obsessed with snakes and with the outdoors. And I mean, as a kid, he was growing up in Switzerland, it's cold. He made a little bed of feathers and sticks on his balcony, his mother's balcony, and spent nights out there. I mean, he was just, his whole life was consumed by this sort of urge, really. And so I think when he got to Pinon and he found them, and that in itself was a feat, he wasn't just sort of this hanger-on who they had to care for and feed and who took away. He was somebody who could hunt with them and could walk barefoot through the jungle with them and learn their language very quickly. And he had an incredible generosity of spirit. He really wanted nothing from them. And I think they understood that. At the same time, I think one of the fascinating things about this whole story is that Bruno looked at the Pinon in this sort of ahistorical way, as these people untouched by the modern era or untouched by history, really. And he wanted to stop the logging to preserve their way of life. But the Pinon had really been in contact with the outside world, with the sedentary dyaks, almost as vassals of them for centuries, and they had been protected from those dyaks by the British, by the white Raja, James Brooke, and they looked at Bruno in a historical way and saw Bruno as this powerful figure of a time when they were protected. And so all of these things get kind of confused. And then the West looked at Bruno, when he tried to stop the logging, he became a hero overnight, and reporters and writers flooded into Sarawak to write about Bruno. And that's the thing, they wrote about Bruno. I mean, the Pinon were less fascinating to them than Bruno themselves. He was the kind of quintessence of this Western idea, this Western trope of the white guy who sheds his clothes and becomes, a native, and yet you can talk to him, sit up next to him at a dinner party and speak in, perfect Swiss German.
Yeah.
So all those things working, and Bruno found it hard to escape from those things.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carl Hoffman about his latest book, The Last Wild Man of Borneo, A True Story of Death and Treasure. You mentioned the White Raja. I mean, this is a fascinating part, is in the 19th century, a white man who came in to the area and in some way protected the Pinon from over-exploitation by their Dayak neighbors. And when the colonial era was over and Malaysia became independent, that's when the logging started. And now the Pinang were no longer protected. So talk about the logging industry, how Bruno got involved with it, and what happened.
Well, you're correct. I mean, when independence came, and then, you know, like all countries, I mean, Malaysia, who had, you know, former colonies, you know, Malaysia wanted development and money, and just as every country does. And you know, Borneo, the Sarawak and Sabah, the two states, Malaysian states that are on part of the island of Borneo, and were, you know, vast, in a Malaysian viewpoint, you know, were vast banks in a way, vast resource places of, you know, billions and billions of dollars in trees. And the Pinan were these backward people who were really the lowest of the low in Malaysian society. I mean, they were often called monkeys, or by the Malaysians themselves, by mainland Malaysians. And that logging, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of crazy ironies. But, you know, the chief minister of Sarawak and the chief environmental minister, I mean, those are the people who created these logging, you know, they handed out logging concessions to their friends and to companies that were created by friends and family, and, you know, ended up making billions and billions of dollars. And that logging was just indiscriminate. I mean, it came in about a year after Bruno was there, and it just started to, you know, the Pinan didn't live in villages. They didn't have built towns, and they didn't have houses. I mean, the whole forest was their home and their larder and their bank, and that world was suddenly under complete assault. And the Pinan had never, you know, the Pinan were shy. I mean, they were nonviolent. They shared everything. They didn't like the sun. And Bruno's sort of magic was that he was able to organize the Pinan in these series of blockades of logging roads, and that brought Malaysian logging to a halt. And you know, that the Malaysians went crazy. They hated Bruno. They saw him as the White Raja returned, and the West saw him as the personification of this sort of white tribal man that every white Westerner dreamed of. And all of those forces came together into this big, wild story that embroiled a lot of people.
And of course, he was aided in this, or in some way he aided some native Dayaks who also had become involved in the logging. But he was the one who said, you can't just go for compensation from the logging companies, because, you know, that way is fraught with betrayal, that you have to do something else. What did he want to create there in the Pinang territory?
Well, Bruno was so radical in a lot of ways. I mean, within Sarawak, there were other Dayak tribes, the Kenya and the Iban, and those Dayaks lived in settled communities of longhouse communities with sort of fruit trees and rice fields. And when the logging initially started, those villages would kind of try to negotiate for compensation for a percentage of the profits, and that usually didn't go well. And they were given, if they were given anything, it was pennies on the dollar. But the Pinan, you know, had nothing. And the Bruno had immense help by local Dayaks who came together with the Pinan. I mean, the Pinan and Bruno would never have been able to do it totally by themselves. But Bruno's thing was no compensation, that when you sit down to negotiate, you are so powerless and so unequal that you will never get adequate compensation, and that there, in fact, there is no adequate compensation for the taking of your forests and essentially your whole culture. And he said, you know, nothing short of a moratorium. And he wanted a quite a large park, if you will, but more than that, you know, we wanted territory set aside for the Pinans, traditional Pinan territory, that would remain under the control of the Pinan and would not be logged. And that was, you know, anathema to Malaysian logging interests. And the sad thing is that ultimately, you know, as hard as Bruno worked and as he gave his whole life, the logging never stopped.
Yeah, talk about where this is now. I mean, Bruno Mensah walked off into the forest and disappeared, never to be seen again. About 10 years after this struggle started, he was deeply disillusioned and depressed about, the poor results of his efforts. Where are we now, and does this foundation still carry out the fight, and what can people do to help it? But start with what's going on now.
Well, Bruno vanished in 2000, and pretty much at that time, all the trees were gone. I mean, Borneo as a whole, both Kalimantan, the Indonesian part, and Sabah and Sarawak and Malaysia have been largely logged out. There are small pockets. There are parks and things. But as a whole, I mean, the great epic primary forests are gone, and now where those forests once stood is being planted by palm oil, and you fly over the island and, mile after mile after mile of palm oil plantations, and it looks green, but it's just a fairly dead monoculture. I mean, there's nothing there but the palm oil itself. And, that said, Bruno did leave behind a foundation, the Bruno Mensah Fund, which an NGO operating out of Basel, Switzerland, and they do good work and, continue their working with Pinans. And I mean, one of the sad things is that I went and I walked for 3 weeks through the very last stands of primary forest with the very last. I mean, we're talking like one family left who refused to settle, a guy named Peng Magut, a Pinan, and his family. But while I was there and sort of meeting up with Peng, I was privy to a meeting that was partly organized with the Bruno Mensah Fund, and in the middle of the forest, and all these Pinan just kind of emerged from the forest. I still don't really understand how they knew about the meeting or how they got there. I mean, and these are settled Pinan, I mean, mostly, and they're, Pinans wearing Chuck Taylors and with ponytails and very modern in many ways, but also carrying blowpipes and able to walk through the forest for days on an end and hunt. I mean, suddenly they were coming out of the forest with civet and bearcat and plunking all this down and whipping out their machetes and building little houses for the meeting. And I felt this sense of that there was still a lot of culture left, even in semi-settled and semi-settled Pinan, and that it was sad that, and the BMF, its foundation, was fighting for it, but Bruno was no longer there to see it because he had kind of given up in a way, because he had been so pure, and that felt just sad to me.
Yeah,
even though the plight of the Pinan as a whole today feels sad as well.
It's a tragic story, and unfortunately one that has been, is on every continent. I guess, we haven't really had time to explore the story of Michael Palmieri, which is equally interesting. So I'd just like to ask you, this book is so rich in its descriptions and in the questions that it poses. What do you feel you would like the reader to most take away from this book?
Well, I think I want people just to ask questions, and to I want to challenge people's ideas all around. I mean, is Bruno gave his whole life to the Pinan. People compared him to Jesus. I mean, they said, people told me Bruno smelled like a shepherd, and yet he could also be selfish, and he didn't age well. I mean, he gave up really and departed. And Michael, on the other hand, is often thought of as somebody who, not often, but there are those who would say Michael took advantage of a situation and made money at the expense of people. And yet Bruno is gone and Michael is still here. And the pieces he collected are, you can see them at the Yale Museum of Art or the Dallas Museum of Art or the Fowler and UCLA. And I want people to question all their assumptions about how they view indigenous people and what their own sort of preconceptions and tropes are. And, the book is supposed to be a kind of a ripping yarn, this adventure tale that also works on a much deeper level and makes people question all their assumptions.
And their complicity as well. It does all of that, Carl Hoffman. The Last Wild Men of Borneo is just a terrific book, and I want to thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Carl Hoffman. Read an excerpt from The Last Wild Men of Borneo by going to writersvoice.net. Next, a true murder mystery at Jane Goodall's Chimpanzee Reserve in Tanzania. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On July 12, 1969, Ruth Davis, a young American volunteer at Dr. Jane Goodall's famous chimpanzee research camp in Tanzania, walked out of camp to follow a chimpanzee into the forest. 6 days later, her body was found floating in a pool at the base of a high waterfall. Dale Peterson wasn't there then, but he has been at Goodall's Chimpanzee Reserve often. He wrote a biography about Goodall and is close friends with her and with the man who was Ruth Davis's lover. Now, in his new book, The Ghosts of Gombe, Peterson reveals for the first time the full story of day-to-day life in Goodall's wilderness camp, the people and the animals, the social conflicts and cultural alignments, and the astonishing friendships that developed between three of the researchers and some of the chimpanzees during the months before Ruth Davis's tragic death. Was her death an accident? Did she jump? Was she pushed? In an extended act of literary forensics, Peterson examines how Ruth's death might have happened and explores how that death haunted two of the survivors for the rest of their lives. Dale Peterson is the author of many books about science and natural history, including Jane Goodall, The Woman Who Redefined Man, and The Moral Lives of Animals. Well, Dale Peterson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you, Francesca. I'm glad to be here.
This book, The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness. The African Wilderness is the Gombe National Park, Gombe Stream National Park in Tanzania. And it's at the Gombe Chimpanzee Preserve that was founded by Jane Goodall. I want you, first of all, to tell us about your connection to Jane Goodall and the preserve. You've been there a number of times.
Well, it was a reserve when Jane first started doing her research there, and then it became a national park. But my relationship with Jane goes back quite a few years. It was 1989 that I first met her, and I am a writer, and I had previously written a book about primates, which involved a lot of travel. I essentially traveled around the world through South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia. And at the end of that book, I realized I wanted to write about a primate species that I had avoided in the previous book, which focused on 12 species. So the primate species I wanted to write about was chimpanzees. And one of the reasons I didn't was there was so much already written about chimps, and there were so many experts already doing research. But after that first book, I decided I would write a book strictly about chimpanzees. And so I contacted a person who wrote an article. I read his name in the article. I got in touch with him. His name was Geza Teleki, and it turned out he was a colleague of Jane's. And I went down to see Geza in Washington, D.C., and I told him that I wanted to write a book about chimps, and after we had talked for a while, he said, well, how would you like to write a book with Jane Goodall? And I said, absolutely, yes. And so Geza introduced me to Jane a couple of weeks later, and Jane and I hit it off, and we decided to do a book together. She was really, at the time, looking for an author to help her with a book, and I was looking for an expert, so it was a nice connection. And co-authoring a book is like getting married quite a bit. It's a very intimate relationship. And there's money involved, there's ego involved, there's time and energy involved. And you know, if it doesn't work out, you can wind up hating the other person. If it does work out, you can wind up having at least a friend for life, if not a, you know, a spouse. Jane and I were friends and remain friends to this day.
She really seems like such an amazing person. I just have to say, parenthetically, I just saw this film biography of her. It's just come out, called Jane. And it was actually it was really thrilling to not only hear her talk about her work, but also to see the chimpanzees that you write so much about in this book, The Ghosts of Gombe, and even to catch glimpses of some of the young students who were there back in 1969 when this story takes place.
Yes, that's right. I saw the film, too, and it was a wonderful film. I, as it happens, I was the consultant on the film, so I had a special relationship with the film, and it was very meaningful for me.
So now to the story. On July 12, 1969, one of the young American volunteers at Jane Goodall's research camp in the national park, in the Gombe Stream National Park, her name was Ruth Davis. She walked out of the camp to follow a chimpanzee that she had often followed into the forest. This was one of the ways that people observed the chimpanzees, by following them into their, you know, natural habitat, let's say, out of the camp. And 6 days later, her body was found floating in a pool at the base of a high waterfall. Tell us about Ruth Davis, and, you know, what was your take on this story to begin with, and then how did you get involved with writing the story so many years, 4 decades later?
Yes, I mentioned that earlier that the person who originally introduced me to Jane was a colleague named Geza Teleki. And Geza Teleki also became a long-term friend of mine after the writing of the book. And it happened that Geza was a student of Jane's during the late 1960s, and it also happens that the young woman who died was Geza's lover. So I was aware of this, and as you know, I wrote the Jane Goodall biography, and I had a chapter about this event, but I covered it very, very briefly, because I didn't know very much. And Geza never talked about this. Jane mentioned it briefly in passing, that Geza's lover, Ruth, his fiance, in fact, they were planning to be married, fell off a cliff and died. That was the story. And so the official account was that it was an accident, and that's what I left it as being. And then Geza, out of the blue, one day in 2008, telephoned me and said, "Dale, I need to talk." And he wanted to talk about Ruth. Geza wasn't in camp when Ruth died. He was back in the United States reporting to his draft board. But he had suppressed everything about Ruth. He had put aside her letters, refused to think about her, and just tried to put the whole thing in the past until about 2008, when he received a letter from somebody asking why Ruth had committed suicide, which was shocking to him to hear this rumor, and to discover that there were other rumors going around, such as that she had been pushed off the cliff. So Geza, the shock of this was really devastating for Geza, and he was also very ill at the time, and in fact was dying. So our conversations, I was his friend, and I, in essence, became his therapist for 2 or 3 years. I'd go down to his home in Washington and just talk to him about Ruth, and we both understood that this might become a book. He knew I was a writer, of course, and so we tape recorded our conversations, and that became the core material of the book. So the core material and the spine of the book is about Ruth, and I felt I had to revive the questions about what happened. I felt it was a mystery, and there were some peculiar things, such as Ruth's journal completely disappeared after her death. So the book is kind of an investigation into this core problem, what happened to Ruth. And that's the spine of the book. But in order to conduct this investigation, I decided simply to do a full portrait of Gombe at that period between 1968 and 1969.
And you actually call the book a collective or cultural biography.
Well, I thought of it as that, and it is in a way that, you know, every person who was there, I wasn't able to interview everyone, but I did my best, and I certainly talked about people that I couldn't interview, but I tried to give a full portrait of everybody, what they were doing, what their relationships were, and just a very kind of intimate portrait, which turned out to be this wonderful picture of day-to-day life at a research station in a remote place. And there were conflicts, there were problems, there were relationships, as you might expect. I feel it was like putting 12 people inside a space capsule and sending them to Mars. There was just a very high level of isolation combined with a high level of intimacy, which was stressful sometimes and wonderful other times. So that's part of the portrait. Some people were smoking marijuana. Other people hated that fact. There was a marital breakup. There were, you know, affairs, that sort of thing. And that's all part of the book and part of the portrait. And I also include the Africans in this. There were African workers there who eventually became critical to the operation, and then eventually Africans took it over and ran it for some time. And I also have a portrait of the African fishermen who were fishing alongside the lake. I try to present them sensitively and also present a cultural portrait of what they were thinking and what their concerns were and what their cultural traditions were. So it's a close focus look at a research camp over 2 years in a remote place. And that's, in essence, how I tried to answer the problem of what happened to Ruth.
And it is a fascinating exploration, I have to say. Yeah, when you say it's a close look, it's a very close look. The descriptions are amazing. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dale Peterson about his book, The Ghosts of Gombe. Now tell us about Ruth.
Well, you know, in some ways, she's still an enigma to me. As I say, her journal disappeared, and Geza, at times, thought it had been taken deliberately. I don't know. But she wrote many letters to Geza, and that's the primary source of information I have about what was going on. She was an amazing person. She was very shy and introverted, and that's a quality that I can easily identify with because I'm that way. So while I was writing the book, I felt this very, just emotionally very close connection with the story. And I think her shyness was a problem with other people, and I'm sure it was. It made it hard for her to communicate on a social level with other people. But it was also a tremendous virtue in terms of working with the chimps, because chimpanzees are very much like humans emotionally and even intellectually, I'll say, but they don't have language. And Ruth didn't like to talk either. So she was actually very good at understanding pre-verbal communications, facial body expressions, gestures, and so I think she was actually one of the best researchers they had there. In fact, I'm sure of that. So she was doing really spectacular work, much of it based upon her strong intuitive sense of the emotional relationships of the chimpanzees with each other. And she was, you know, working hard when she died. I will say that she was also pushing herself very hard. She was, you know, not a big person. She weighed maybe 105 pounds, which makes her about the weight of some of the male chimps. And she was doing very, very long walks following chimps through the forest. And the forest itself is an extremely rugged and challenging environment, very steep. They're on a very steep mountainside or an escarpment, really. So I know that physically she was stressing herself, and I know psychologically she was under some stress because, you know, when Geza left and her intimate friend was gone, she was having trouble connecting with other people in camp.
You mentioned about her following this chimp. This was something that the researchers did. It seems to me that this was something that actually these researchers themselves initiated. I mean, when Jane Goodall first came, everything was done in the camp. And in fact, they even, you know, had this banana box that they could control remotely so that the chimps would be attracted to coming in the camp and could be observed, because otherwise they just came intermittently and it wasn't, you know, they were hard to observe. But the researchers wanted to follow them to see what they were like in their own habitat, basically. Is that right?
Well, it's half right. You know, Jane, when she came originally to Gombe in 1960, she followed the chimps through the forest, and she did a lot of this work of just going out in the forest trying to find them. Of course, for the first 6 months, they were terrified of her, and they would disappear the minute they saw her. But eventually, they got used to her. So the banana feeding, which developed slowly and started in 1962, very gradually, became a way to make it possible for researchers who didn't have the energy and the stamina of Jane to do good research. So one thing about Gombe, I've just said it's very, very rugged, and what that means is it's very, very hard to find them in the forest. If they want to disappear, they can easily do that. So the banana feeding brought the chimps in the camp on a regular basis, and Jane would have researchers, even ones who had only spent a few months getting acclimatized, doing good research in camp because the chimps were there every day. The chimps would come in for the bananas. It was like a wonderful, you know, fruit tree or something. They didn't care about the people. They ignored the people, and they went about their daily lives just pretty much close to natural behavior, I think. You know, really, I'm convinced it was a very successful research protocol, and it had the advantage of giving lots and lots of contact with the chimps, which no one could possibly have if you tried to just find them in the forest. They're just too difficult to follow. What happened was the research protocol, the banana feeding, turned out had a complicating factors appeared in about 1968, which was a group of baboons discovered that same food source. And so, well, the chimps were coming in to get the bananas, so were the baboons. And that was not a healthy mixture. The baboons were traveling in troops of up to 50 individuals. The males are almost as big as chimps. Also, they're quite big. I'd guess they'd, you know, the males would weigh 65, 70 pounds. And they're formidable animals. They have, you know, large fang-like canine teeth, and they can be very aggressive. So there was a lot of conflict between the chimpanzees and the baboons. And as a result of that conflict, the researchers decided, and Jane agreed with this, that they would reduce the banana feeding radically. Instead of every day putting out bananas, they would do it once every 5 or 6 or 7 days. And that discouraged the baboons. The chimps would still come in to check to see if there were bananas. But that change in the protocol also gave the researchers time to try following the chimpanzees in the forest. There were 3 researchers who did that. It was not easy, as I say. And the interesting thing was you actually couldn't do it. A person couldn't follow a chimpanzee unless the chimpanzee deliberately let you. And what that meant in turn was that certain individual chimps would select the person they wanted to follow them. So they wouldn't let anyone else follow them because it was they didn't like everybody the same, and so they had favorites among the people. You know, there was a chimpanzee named Leaky who would only let Gazetelike follow him. And then there was a chimpanzee named Hugh who really didn't like people, and he would only let Ruth follow him. So in that way, there developed a series of strange and fascinating friendships between individual chimpanzees and individual people. You know, the chimps would select who was going to follow them, and the people gradually became enamored of the chimps they were following. Their real relationships developed. And it was an astonishing thing, and I think also, good science. I think they were learning a lot by following chimps into the forest.
Yeah, one of those researchers who got very close to Hugh was Carol. And you have a wonderful description of the relationship that they developed with each other, the friendship. Hugh actually had a little bit of amorous notions about Carol as well.
Yeah, Ruth, you're speaking of Ruth.
It was Ruth?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So who is it who called their observation wonderful wordless witnessing?
That was Carol.
Okay.
And a wonderful phrase.
It really is. It sounds like meditation.
Yeah. Carol really had a way with words. And the amorous relationship did develop, but was, never consummated, of course. And it was, for Ruth, it was slightly disturbing. But she also just really liked Hugh a lot, so it was not that disturbing. She was, had two opinions about it. And Ruth described in her letters some of that relationship, so we know that Hugh, who was one of the biggest males, very, very strong and, built like an Olympic weightlifter, and, potentially very dangerous, just really seemed to like Ruth and seemed to be pleased when she was around. And as I say, he would let her follow him when he wouldn't let anybody else do that. And a couple of times he came and sat down in front of her as if he wanted her to groom him, which is what chimps do with each other. And that was against the rules at Gombe, so Ruth didn't do it. Then another time, even more forward, Hugh, one time in the forest, made a signal to Ruth that was a sexual signal. When chimps do it to each other, only at this place, it's not, it's not genetic, it's a cultural communication. Only at Gombe, when males want a female to come with them deeper into the forest, they will signal by waving a branch, which causes a distinctive swishing in the leaves, and then giving a gestural signal. And Hugh did that to Ruth, and he did it twice. She ignored it both times. The first time, when she didn't respond, he just decided, I guess this is another crazy person. The second time, he did what a chimp normally would do with a female who doesn't respond, a male would do, which is essentially grab her. And he dragged her along the ground for 15 feet before realizing, I'm sure this is what happened, because with a female, it would be far more violent and aggressive female chimp. With Ruth, he just realized, I've made a mistake. This is not a chimpanzee. This is that strange person. And so he just let go and just stopped. But it was striking and startling and quite amazing.
One of the things that's also interesting in this book is that you explore the different attitudes towards scientific research. Jane Goodall herself was brought into the chimp project by Lewis Leakey precisely because she did not have an academic background.
Right. Yeah.
So I'd like you to kind of address that, and also the kinds of tensions that began to develop among the students later on between right. those who, you know, came in with this whole quantitative data-driven
right.
attitude
yeah.
and the others.
Well, the data-driven work was coming from Cambridge University and as part of a European tradition of ethology, very, very science-based kind of statistics-based science of animal behavior. And Jane was trained in that area, actually, but she didn't begin there. She began, as you mentioned, essentially a naive person who loved animals and who had a wonderful intuitive sense about animals. The fact is, however, that when she started, she was the first person ever to study chimpanzees to any degree. So nobody knew how to study chimps. I mean, there was, you know, nobody, in fact, there were a lot of people believed they were impossible to study in the wild because they would rip you to pieces. And that's why it was hard to get anybody to go out and study them. Jane simply didn't believe that. And she believed that if you simply presented yourself as a non-threatening presence, that eventually they would get used to your presence in the forest and they wouldn't run every time they saw you or attack. And she was right. You know, her data collection at first was not, you know, was common among American zoologists and also among some people in England, and it was just, you know, follow them, take notes of behavior, time the notes, take good notes, and she did all of that. The description of that method is, we're calling it narrative note-taking. You know, it's describing a picture of what happens from minute to minute. And that's what Jane started with and what she also transmitted to her early students. At the same time, she went to Cambridge University, got a PhD in ethology, and her professor was a strong ethologist who believed in a kind of data collection that was very analytical and based upon mathematics and very strict kind of record keeping, in which you identify behaviors and you identify who's doing it and mathematically represent it. So that was a transition that was happening at the time. Jane was bringing in other people from Cambridge, and they were the ones who were promoting this kind of record keeping, and that was the system, the protocol that would eventually win, and the narrative record keeping would become increasingly less relevant over time. But it was still, during the 60s, it was still going on. So you're right, it's a conflict between systems.
So it seems like so much of the value of what the world has learned from Jane Goodall's whole project of observing the chimps along with all the people that she brought in to do that has been our understanding of how similar chimps
right.
and humans are. And it seems to me that the narrative style is
right.
very key to that. And
yeah.
I wonder, do you think that if we had just started and always just had the quantitative, whether that would have emerged as an understanding?
That's a really, really good question, and I think the answer is yes, you need a narrative style, and you need somebody like Jane Goodall and somebody who just, you know, refuses to think in mathematical terms about animals and thinks in personal terms. She discovered they have personalities, they have character, there are relationships, they have emotions, they have minds. They make plans. All of these things were intuitive discoveries that she documented through her narrative method. And they would be very, very hard to document if you just approached them as a mathematical problem to solve. So you're absolutely right. On the other hand, I think the mathematical methods provide a wonderful kind of irrefutable a degree of evidence about what's going on and really ultimately can back up the narrative material.
So, in fact, maybe the good thing to do is to chew gum and walk at the same time and use both.
Yeah, both of them, I think, are very useful, but they are quite different.
Well, we have just touched the surface in some ways of this wonderful book, The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness. And actually, before we go, speaking of ghosts, it sounds like Geza and his wife both saw the ghost of Ruth on the same night. They were sleeping in different rooms because he tossed and turned so much because he was so ill. So what do you make of that manifestation?
Well, you know, I open the book with the appearance of Ruth to Geza. I don't really believe in ghosts in the style of, you know, ghost stories. I believe in ghosts as psychological manifestations of something internal. I think in Geza's case, he had a deep level of grief that was not resolved until 2008, when he began to face what he had been suppressing for most of his life. But it's a pretty striking thing, and even more striking is the fact that Carol at Gombe, who is the one who found Ruth's body, also reported a vision of Ruth. And Ruth, when the search for the body was going on, Carol was not able to participate because she was in bed with malaria. And then one night, Ruth came in. This is Carol's description of it. Ruth came in the door and demanded, "Why haven't you come to find me?" And so that was another vision. And Carol actually got up the next day and, in spite of being weak from malaria, went out and within a couple of days found the body.
It is remarkable. But I guess I find even more remarkable that Geza had a vision and his wife had the same vision.
That's right.
So In some ways, it's not just a personal psychological manifestation.
Yeah.
But I guess we have to leave that mystery there where it is. Dale Peterson, it has been so interesting to talk with you about this terrific book, The Ghosts of Gombe.
Well, thank you, Francesca. Great to talk to you, too.
Dale Peterson is the author of many books about science and natural history, including Jane Goodall, The Woman Who Redefined Man, and The Moral Lives of Animals. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our interview with him about the latter book and his memoir, Where Have All the Animals Gone? That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.